We're now joined by Meb Faber, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Cambria, who currently offers 11 ETFs with over $650 million invested, including the Cambria Trinity ETF, which we'll spotlight today. Meb, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, Meb, so we are actually recording this a day early. You're in Minneapolis attending the Final Four, where your alma mater, the University of Virginia, is playing in the national title game tonight. So I'm a college hoops junkie. Before we talk ETFs, I have to ask you about the game on Saturday night and the game tonight. First, I'm assuming you agree it was a foul call on Auburn on the three-point attempt?
I think, you know, no question it was a foul. Now, maybe also been no question that it was a double dribble, but who knows? But I think, look, there's been a lot of emotions in the past year as a Virginia fan. First time in history, a one seed lost to a 16, and then a year later you find yourself squeaking by in two last-second games. So hopefully by the time this airs, we'll be celebrating a championship. If not, it's been a great year.
So, yeah, do you feel like whatever happens tonight, the title game appearance makes up for the loss to the 16 seed last year?
You know, you would like to think so. It's hard to, I also grew up as a Denver Bronco fan, so there was a lot of heartbreak repeatedly as a young child. People used to always say, just all that matters is you get there. But then until you really win one, it's a different feeling.
Well, it should be a lot of fun. Certainly enjoy the game tonight. All right, so let's talk ETFs. We're going to spotlight the Cambria Trinity ETF, ticker symbol TRTY. This launched in September of last year, and this has generated a lot of buzz. I know it was up for several ETF.com awards, including Best New ETF and Best New Alternatives ETF. Walk us through the basics here. What's the investment strategy? What does this hold? What's the overall goal?
Sure. So the quick background is that, you know, our company only launches funds that I personally want to invest in. You know, there's a lot of managers. It surprises a lot of people. But there's this statistic about mutual fund managers, depending on the category, often 50, 60, 70% of the managers don't invest a single dollar into their own fund, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. They expect you to buy it, and they want to sell it to you, but they don't invest. And so I have almost all my net worth public assets invested in this fund, but that's the background because I wanted to invest in something that didn't exist. So there's not that many asset allocation ETFs out there. There's maybe a dozen, and they manage in the single-digit billions of dollars, which is good. So you compare it to the expensive tax-inefficient mutual funds, where many are higher fee, and the average mutual fund fee is about 1.25%, and they manage over $1 trillion. So I said, I would like an asset allocation fund that has some of the benefits of the ETF structure, low cost, tax efficient, some of the benefits of a buy and hold investing strategy, and some of the benefits of some alternative strategies like trend following. And I'm happy to give you a broad overview of kind of the investment philosophy behind it, but I always think it's important to discuss skin in the game and the structure first and intentions, because a lot of people still to this day have the old school higher fee asset allocation structures, which I think are very suboptimal.
You know, when I look at the asset allocation ETF space, it has been a bit slow to grow overall. I think part of that is because ETFs obviously aren't as prevalent in 401ks. And, you know, I'm curious, and yes, I want to get into exactly what this ETF does in terms of investment philosophy, but, you know, is this for individual investors, advisors? And the reason I ask is because you and I both know a single asset allocation ETF can be highly successful for investors holding it over a long term. But, you know, some investment advisors, maybe most, they're not going to use these because they don't want their clients receiving a statement with just one ETF on it. And I'm not saying that's right, but do you see that as a problem in terms of scaling this ETF?
You hit the nail on the head where so much of what we do, and I love financial advisors, so much of what they do is also behavioral coaching, you know, and so to be able to talk to a client who calls you up and say, hey, why we only own one fund? What am I paying you for? Despite the fact that it owns 20 other ETFs that own 20,000 securities around the world, you know, it's like the ultimate in diversification, but we only own one. What are you crazy? And so I think solutions to solve those sort of behavioral issues are important. There's people, weird people like me, that just, that's what they own. They own one holding, and that's it. But most aren't crazy like me. So what way we find it is we find individuals using it as a core holding, and they may buy stuff as satellites around it. We also find that a lot of financial advisors, in some cases, because of the way that it invests, they may actually use it as that alternative or satellite as well to round out their standard exposure. And then there's some advisors, too, that say, you know what, I'm just going to use all the small accounts for the children of the clients or relatives that may be smaller. We'll just put them into this fund as a one-size-fits-all solution for a lot of people.
Okay, so tell us more about the specific investment philosophy. This is actively managed. What are the individual holdings? How are those determined? What are the allocation percentages?
So we wrote a book years ago called Global Asset Allocation, and it's free on our website. If you go there, it's also on Amazon. And we walk through about 20 of the most famous asset allocation models as recommended by some of the most famous gurus on Wall Street, Warren Buffett, David Swensen, Rob Arnott. And we found that for most buy and hold asset allocations, they actually, and this is over a 50-year period, the actual allocation didn't matter that much as long as you had some of the main ingredients: stocks, global bonds, global real assets like commodities and real estate. And what we found for buy and hold is that the most important thing is you didn't pay a lot in fees. And so buy and hold is great. The global market portfolio is great. The problem most people have with buy and hold is they really struggle during recessions because of the drawdowns, and everything kind of happens at once. So your portfolio may be down 20, 30, 50%, but you also lost your job, and Lehman's going under, and the economy is doing poorly, and your house price is going down. So it all happens at once, and that's why people often sell at the bottom, panic, never to invest again. So buy and hold is fine, but it struggles for those reasons. On the flip side, there's a strategy we employ. It's been around for over 100 years since the time of Charles Dow, called trend following. And that strategy, all of this is systematic, it's rules-based, it's quantitative. And we apply trend following strategies across the globe and through a number of different funds. And trend following, over time, gets you to the same place as buy and hold historically. It may do even better. But the biggest benefit is usually a reduction in risk, a reduction in drawdown for the portfolio. The problem with trend following, you know, no investment approach is perfect. The problem with trend following is it also has times and periods where it lags buy and hold. The last 10 years is a great example. So the biggest problem you have with trend following is not the traditional drawdowns during a recession in bear market, because usually those funds will either be in cash or short. The problem, so they would have probably a good year in 2008. The problem those have is when your neighbor's making money, when the S&P is rocking like it has been for the last 10 years, you may look different, you may look worse. And so what we do in Trinity is we combine the two ideas. We say 50% in buy and hold type of strategies, 50% in trend following type of strategies, and it creates a nice yin yang to where, and this last year is a good example, where the last quarter of 2017, you would have been a little nervous with buy and hold because you got a terrible quarter, or excuse me, 2018. The years are flying by. And then 2019, the markets ripped right back up. The buy and hold would have done great, but trend following might have lagged. So it creates a portfolio that naturally responds to what's going on in the world. And most importantly, I think it will help people really stick with their investing plan better than they would with either one alone.
Can you go short an asset class here, like through an inverse ETF?
We don't allocate to inverse ETFs. However, some of the funds themselves may go short. So there's a couple of funds in there that pursue managed futures, which has been a god-awful asset strategy for the past 10 years. But they can easily go short any market.
And can you talk a little bit about your ETF due diligence process here? How do you determine which ETFs will represent a given asset class or strategy?
This is an important topic because there's over 2,000 ETFs out there, and people listening may shake their heads until they realize there's over 10,000 mutual funds and 10,000 hedge funds. So it's a world of opportunity, but also buyer beware. You know, certainly I think there's a lot of common sense to be had. You know, in general, the ETF structure is great, but as learned with people's experience with some of the volatility and leverage funds, you know, you really got to know what you buy. So there's some common sense going on. We stay away from the weird funds. We stay away from traditionally funds that have leverage or exchange-traded notes. We obviously tend towards very low-cost funds when we can, and tax-efficient structures. And then it's really about representative asset class strategy and methodology. So I'm agnostic as to passive and active. You know, we certainly prefer quantitative and rules-based, which can exist in either. But, you know, it depends on the asset class. For equities, what we often tell people, and I wish we had another hour to talk about this, but, you know, if you're doing market cap-weighted investing, those funds are basically a commodity at this point and basically free, which is awesome. It's an awesome time to be an investor if you can invest in a fund that's 0.05% fee. But that's not all that matters, of course. And a lot of funds out there that may charge more, they end up being closet indexing funds. So if you're going to move away from market cap, you got to be pretty active. You got to be pretty concentrated, weird, and different. A lot of people, that's not comfortable. But we're a little weird and different, so we don't mind. So it's a mix of art, mix of science, a mix of experience and common sense, too.
You mentioned fees. Did I see correctly that the management fee on Trinity is zero? Investors just pay the fees on the underlying ETFs?
Yeah, we were the first to do this, and you see this a lot more now. But we said, look, it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to charge a wrapper fee on this fund because it's a fund of funds. And, you know, the all-in fee, so we have a couple of these funds, and this is, I think it's around 0.65, 0.66, somewhere around there, because of the underlying funds. But yeah, we felt it was the correct thing to do not to charge management fee. But our GAA, which is the buy and hold version of this ETF, was the first to do that with a no permanent 0% management fee.
Out of curiosity, where did you come up with a Trinity name?
You know, the concept, we wanted to relay the concept of, it was like three legs of a stool, and there was two parts of it. The first was that we wanted exposure to three global asset classes, so global stocks, global bonds, and global real assets. And a lot of investors, you know, it's kind of like making cookies, where as long as you have some butter, flour, sugar, chocolate chips, your cookies will probably end up okay. The exact amount doesn't matter. But if you start to exclude one of those categories, it's probably not a great way to do it. Then you end up with terrible-tasting gluten-free cookies or something. I don't know. So the Trinity concept was stocks, bonds, global real assets. And then on the flip side is of the strategies, we wanted value strategies in there. It's out there. They're important. We wanted momentum and then trend. And so the combination of those concepts we thought was kind of the underlying idea behind the name Trinity.
Our guest is Meb Faber, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Cambria. Meb, we have just a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about something you tweeted out a few weeks ago, because I think this is relevant to the Trinity ETF. And this was fantastic. You tweeted out 10 investment beliefs you hold, but that you don't think the vast majority of your peers share. And you also solicited feedback from people on the same. I just want to ask you about a couple. One was that U.S. investors should be allocating a minimum of 50% of their stock allocation to non-U.S. countries. And, you know, look, you got some pushback on this one. I would say the most common arguments were that something like the S&P 500, those companies already generate half of their revenue overseas, so you already have international exposure if you own that. And then I think the other one was if you adjust for sector composition, maybe valuations overseas don't look so attractive right now. I know we could probably spend, you know, a few hours on both of these, but can you just give us your quick rebuttal here?
You hit a nerve on this one. And my first response, and this is extremely important, it's extremely important, particularly right now. And the reason being, if you invest in, say, just stocks, the global portfolio. Most investors don't know this, but the U.S. is only half. So your starting point, if you're a passive, John Bogle, through the wool, passive investor, your starting point should be you put half in the rest of the world. Now, if you want to make an active bet, and the average investor in the U.S. puts about 70 to 80% of their stock assets in the U.S., realize that's fine. I don't think it is, but that's fine. But realize you're making a extremely concentrated active bet. So at least be aware of it. But most investors aren't. The funny thing is, this happens everywhere in the world. I was just in Canada. My Canadian friends do the same thing. I was in Japan. They do the same thing. They put 80% in their own market. And it's a crazy idea. This concentration is not rewarded. On top of that, it's a particularly bad idea in the U.S. right now, because we didn't talk about valuations, but the U.S. stock market around the globe is one of the most expensive in the world. It's not a bubble. It's not crazy, but we project low single digits for U.S. stocks going forward for the next 10 years, whereas the rest of the world is reasonably priced to downright cheap. And that's the biggest problem with market cap weighting, is it often puts you the largest amount that you allocate into some of the most expensive markets. Think back to the 1980s in Japan. In the 80s, the number one stock market in the world was Japan. You put most of your money at its peak in a market that had a price-earnings ratio of 100. The biggest bubble we've ever seen, Japan has had zero returns for 30 years since. The U.S. isn't that bad. It's around a value of around 30 right now versus historically around 17. And it's been as high as 45, so it's not totally crazy. And then real quickly, you touched on sectors. That's absolutely true. You talked about foreign revenue. Absolutely true. But the rebuttal is, don't you think that every country around the world also has exposure to foreign revenue? Europe's actually higher than the U.S., 50%. Ireland's like 70 or 80%. So the takeaway is, in a world of globalization where you may have a Mexican company that has 100% of its revenues from Sweden, is that a Mexican company or is it a Swedish company? In a world of globalization where borders don't matter, it's so important to be border, country, sector agnostic and to go where value is, wherever that may be. And so I'm not saying put 100% in foreign, although I think that would be totally reasonable. I don't even say put 60% in foreign, like some of our portfolios do. I think you say you start with the global average and then go from there. If you want to be a value investor, you could actually add more. And if you're going to put all in the U.S., at least realize your bias, your home country bias, and realize that the reasons you give are also the same reasons someone in Brazil or Greece or Russia would give. But if you asked them how that would work out during their lifetime, they would tell you it's a fundamentally awful idea.
All right, we have about a minute left. One other one I wanted to ask you about. You said a basic low-cost global market portfolio of ETFs will outperform the vast majority of institutions over time. And, you know, I think to a large degree some of this relates to what we were just discussing on international allocations. But why do you think it's so hard for investors, whether individual or institutional, to take this more simplistic approach?
We do a number of these, what we call office hours calls, where we talk to investors all around the world, institutions, individuals, and everyone thinks they have very unique and particular investment concerns and situations. But in general, it turns out people have mostly similar situations. First of all, often investors own an investment salad they've been cobbling together over years, and they look at their portfolio and they're like, I don't even recognize half this stuff, but I bought it and I'm emotionally wedded to it. And then, you know, you say, what's your ideal portfolio? It looks nothing like their current portfolio. And then they have this secret desire to gamble and a secret desire to complicate the process. And complicate is in line with institutions. Certainly so many of them, they look down on individuals, but they make the same mistakes. They're overconfident. They say they have a rigorous process, but it ends up just being complicated, meaning they invest so much into these really high fee funds. These private equity funds essentially charge like 7% per year, you know. So there's this complicated process, and all of this is compounded and made worse by the fact that almost every investor we talk to doesn't have a written investment plan, and so everyone's kind of just winging it, shooting from the hip, and that often is fine in many years like this. But once you get into certain years like an 08 or another bear market, it really causes bad behavior. So a lot of that wrapped in is kind of the reason behind it. I think that institutions, the biggest problem they face is paying really high fees. You know, they still are smitten with a lot of the really high fee funds. And I'm not against high fee funds. You charge 2 and 20, God bless you. But just realize the more you charge, the higher the bar gets. And so just the iron law of math is, if you have a zero fee fund, or pretty close to it, and there's never been a better time to be an investor. For you can invest in the world for free. That's a pretty high bar to beat if you're paying people a lot more than that.
Well, Mab, on that note, we'll have to leave it there. Really enjoyed the conversation today. Always appreciate your time. Good luck to Virginia tonight. Enjoy the game.
Thanks so much, and go Hoos.
That was Meb Faber, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Cambria. And I'm going to give you two websites to check out. First, you can learn more about the Cambria ETFs by visiting cambriafunds.com. And then Meb has just some fantastic content, a blog, podcast, books. Highly recommend visiting mebfaber.com for that. Meb's also a great follow on Twitter.